The Weekend is here. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Coming up later in the program, we're going to take a look at the economic impact of untreated mental health illness. Up first in the show, resting on the corner of Davis and Linden Avenues, the Davis Linden's brick facade has overlooked East Dayton since the late 1800s. What started as a hub for local industry has transformed over the years to allow the addition of creative entrepreneurs within its walls. WISO's Shea Frank recently visited with some of those unique tenants that are part of what is now called the Creative Commerce, or C2, initiative.
When I walk into the 115,000-square-foot building, the sound of its preserved, creaking floors transport me to its early years of production. The Davis Sewing Machine Company moved into the building in 1889, leaving its mark on the now rippled floorboards. The signs of heavy machinery and the footfalls of employees hard at work. Those historic floors now feel the footsteps of over 85 tenants. Some are traditional businesses like electricians, but there's also many artists. From photographers to musicians to wood and glass workers. Matthew Derringer has been the building's owner for about 10 years, spending about $500,000 to make sure those tenants will be part of that history for years to come. That includes longtime tenant at the facility, Michael J. Bashaw.
Wow. Oh, you think that's wow? Wait till you step inside.
There's more.
His musical sculptures and other pieces have been produced and stored at the Davis Linden building for 45 years. He says he has seen numerous tenants venture in and out of the space over the past few decades.
Back in the day, there were machine shops and pattern makers and carpenters. And now there's a lot more, I think, diverse occupants.
In his studio, Bashaw demonstrates how a number of his massive sound sculptures work.
Marimba sculpture.
They're made with salvaged materials such as old Sunbeam mixers, Italian doorbells, table legs, and 100-year-old rosewood bars.
Lately, I've been working with aluminum, making kind of tuning forks out of aluminum.
Below Bashaw's massive upstairs studio, other tenants are busy crafting some more practical everyday pieces.
In a nutshell, White Birch Carpentry is a full-service custom woodworking shop. We do everything from furniture building to high-end finished carpentry.
That was Jim Brenneman. He heads White Birch Carpentry, which has had a workshop in the building since the start of 2025. His company has worked on many notable local projects, including Grist Provision's current West 5th Street location, as well as its upcoming second storefront in the Oregon District.
I've built also some black walnut bourbon tables that are in Arrow Wine on the Far Hills location.
According to Brenneman, collaboration is a big part of the C2 initiative. If he needs something for a project, he doesn't have to look too far.
There's a couple metal workers, you know, that are in the shop, and I sometimes look at doing metal bases for tables and things like that. If I need some CNC work done, there's a couple people that do some small CNC work here.
Rounding the corners of the worn steel and brick halls inside the building, I am met with endless studio doors. C2 Operations Manager Rebecca Brunfield is showing me around. She says the building's industrial design allows current tenants to bring in and ship out larger products. That includes its massive freight elevator, which holds 5,000 pounds.
We can move just about anything any tenant wants or needs to move into or out of this building. We are in a location where you're only minutes from downtown, but you're also quick access to the highway to get to any of the other major cities or whatever you would need.
In one of the initiative's larger studio spaces in the upper level of the building that utilizes these services is a typewriter sale and repair shop, TV Writers Plus. The shop has expanded over time to accommodate its growing collection. Owners of TB Writers Plus, Rebecca Brumfield and her husband Trevor Brumfield, have been working to connect with members of the typewriter community for a documentary project. Brumfield says they have also started manufacturing parts for typewriters with a new 3D resin printer.
We've been having to get lucky and find old vendors who still had stuff or have to steal parts off of other machines and condemn them.
And marrying together the old and the new is what the C2 initiative is all about. The initiative's publicist, Jerry Deere, says whether it's preserving and refurbishing historic typewriters or weathered 100-year-old floors, the Davis Linden Building is working to be a collaborative hub of the future while abiding by the historic commerce of its past.
That machine is going to be here in 80 years. This building, the way Matt's doing it, is going to be here in another 80 years. Otherwise, it would have been just another one of these old factory buildings sitting empty, waiting for somebody to come and do something with it while it was falling down around them.
For WYSO News, I'm Shay Frank.
Up next on WYSO Weekend, the economic impact of untreated mental illness is wide-ranging. Emotional, physical, social, and economic. A study published by Wright State University, the Greater Dayton Area Hospital Association, and One Morning says untreated mental illness costs the Greater Dayton region nearly $30 billion a year. We spoke with the study's author, Dr. Thomas Trainer, professor emeritus of economics at Wright State University, who discusses his findings and a note, this story discusses suicide.
I found that roughly 24% of this region's population is affected by mental illness. So of that 24%, roughly 5% are experiencing serious mental illness. And serious mental illness is best defined as debilitating mental illness, to the point where people are just not able to function anywhere near a normal human life. The other roughly 20% or nearly 20%, I should say, who are suffering other forms of mental illness are suffering mental illness of a degree that's anywhere from very mild, meaning it might be significantly impacting their life for, let's say, a week out of the year, something that they tend to be able to recover from or tend to recover from fairly quickly, to situations where they are pretty close to suffering serious mental illness. So it's pretty impactful to their lives, but it isn't quite classified as serious or debilitating.
So what numbers did you find in terms of the economic impact of mental illness in Southwest Ohio?
So I looked at basically counting up all the areas through which mental illness impacts the economy or has economic impacts. And they include spending on mental health care, of course, as well as spending on physical health care that is a result of mental illness. It causes unemployment, productivity loss in the workplace due to increased inattention or inability to focus on work. It can cause premature deaths like suicides and premature deaths from the same cardiovascular and respiratory illnesses. It causes increases in crime, which result in increased expenses on incarceration and mental illness and health care among prisoners. It can cause increased homelessness, which increases costs of social support groups that support homeless populations. It also has an emotional impact on family and friends of people who are suffering mental illness. That primarily comes in the form of those who are experience the loss of a loved one due to suicide or early death from a physical illness due to mental illness. And then, of course, reduced educational attainment is a huge factor on the local economy as well. So young people suffering from mental illness are more likely to drop out of high school. They're more likely to not attend or drop out early from post-secondary education. And so that reduces the productivity of the workforce. So I divided these into the direct expenses, which represents the dollars spent dealing with problems caused by mental illness that were diverted from other uses that could also support society or support families if they weren't spent due to problems created by mental illness. And that came out to $3.25 billion in 2023. The next major area that I measured was the impact on the region's GDP, the total amount of output produced by the region in dollars, which is essentially the total amount of income earned in the region in dollars. And that came out to $12.65 billion, or roughly 9%, or a little bit more than 9% of the local GDP for the 11 counties. And then the last cost category is actually one that's not related to actual dollars spent or actual dollars lost, but it's the economic value to families and friends of losing a loved one to suicide or more frequently to early death due to cardiac problems, respiratory problems, and so on. And that totals to, $13.92 billion.
I was just going to ask you what hopes you have of the results of the study.
I think the hopes are to increase awareness to just how big of a problem this is. I think a lot of businesses, or at least medium and larger sized businesses, can probably look at this and hopefully realize that there's a significant improvement in productivity that could be achieved, and a commensurate increase in profits that could be achieved. And by pursuing that, it also would benefit sort of social services. It would benefit their employees' personal lives quite a bit, too.
That was Dr. Thomas Trainer, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Wright State University, who authored that study of the economic impact of untreated mental illness in our area. For more on this, Mike also spoke with the Director of Counseling and Wellness Services at Wright State University, Dr. Barbara Marsh, who gives us strategies that employers can use to reduce these impacts at their businesses.
It's really changing the culture within those organizations to make mental health a priority. So it's allowing individuals to feel comfortable if they are struggling with their mental well-being. And we all struggle with our mental well-being at some point in time in our lives. Stressors hit us every day. So it's having employers to be willing to have the conversation within their workplaces, making sure that employees know where the resources are, and that we're not waiting until it does become a productivity or a work issue with someone where it is affecting their work environment. One of the things that employers can do is become trained in mental health first aid, which is an evidence-based practice that allows employers to teach their employees on how to have those conversations with people that may be struggling. So it's opening up the conversation, normalizing it in the workplace, but also reducing that stigma so that people, when they are struggling and they need assistance or support, they're more likely to reach out for help.
Is this more than just an HR issue?
Yes, it's absolutely more than a human resource issue, and certainly the leadership, that really needs to come from the top down within an organization, that mental health is a priority within that organization. And employees feel that they know that they feel valued, or they know that they are valued, and they know that their mental health is seen as a priority within that organization.
Could it be something as easy, if you will, as more time off, flexible hours, an employee assistance program offered by the employer?
Yes, those are certainly some really great examples that employers could implement within their businesses. You know, it really truly is changing a culture within an organization to really look at mental health as a priority, and then finding what is the best way to serve their employees. If employers are addressing the mental health of their employees, and the employees will feel valued, and they will be able to retain their employees long term. So there's a huge return on investment for our business community if they are addressing the mental health needs of their employees long term.
From an employer's perspective, what do you do with an employee who may have an issue but simply does not want to address it?
Well, certainly you can, make sure that the employee is given the resources. Most organizations have an employee assistance program, or that the Human Resource Department is aware of those community resources that they can link or refer that individual to.
What should an employee do if they feel they need help for any kind of mental health issue, whether it's physiological or psychological or just something happening in their lives?
They can certainly reach out to their employee assistance program. There's also resources online that individuals can go to. There is a Get Help Now, a site that has all types of behavioral health care resources that are available. There is a national line that is available by dialing 988 that they can just call and talk to someone. There are resources available in the community. There are also a lot of private therapists or counselors that are available that can see people as well.
What would you say to someone who feels like they have too much pride to ask for help, that they feel it'll go away on its own, or they're afraid that there might be some kind of stigma attached to them if they ask for help?
You don't have to carry everything on your own. Reaching out for help doesn't make you weak. It actually shows courage. And you're in control of what support looks like for you. It doesn't have to mean a big step. Just even taking the time or taking the chance of talking to someone that may be a trustworthy person around you could mean that they can help you. So everyone needs help sometimes, even the strongest people. And it's really, really okay to lean on others when you are struggling.
That was Dr. Barbara Marsh, Director of Counseling and Wellness Services at Wright State University, speaking with WYSO's Mike Frazier. You can find both of these conversations online at wyso.org and see the study about the economic impact of untreated mental illness in Southwest Ohio at wright.edu/newsroom. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Thanks so much for sharing your weekend with WYSO. So how about a little music? Dayton band Yuppie is releasing a new EP called Normally on November 5th. The band visited the WYSO studios last week for a session on Kaleidoscope and talked to host Juliet Frumholt about the upcoming release.
I have to say, I love the title of this one, given that the last one was Peculiar. So we're moving in a direction here, perhaps.
We're getting good with band bad, you know, anxieties and the things of the world.
All the things. Tell me a little bit about the process of putting this one together. I know you worked at Real Love in mm-hmm. Dayton.
So we worked with Patrick Himes again, the wizard that man is. So over the past 6 months, we've made about 6-8 songs, but we compiled it down to 4. For this new EP called Normally. Colin, Casey, what do you guys do?
Yeah, we basically just kind of been in and out of the studio. We didn't really have any, like, plans to release it at any particular time. It was just kind of like, okay, when's everybody free? When are we going to do this? And we just kind of all show up. And sometimes I'll literally just be sitting there on the back of the couch just poking Zach with a little stick, like, hey, do this.
More.
Do that.
More something.
Hey, do it better. But yeah, that's what we've been doing for the last few months. We've been playing out live a little bit, trying to hone in the sound a little bit as well. Yeah.
Operation Encore is a nonprofit that has helped me with my music. Being a Marine Corps veteran, they provide resources for me to be able to fund Yuppie in these projects. So I would say the thing about Normally that I'm loving so much is that it's about trying to fit into a world that feels crooked and realizing you're better off leaning into discomfort than faking peace. It's not about being okay. It's just about being honest. So some of the songs touch on real world events. And it was something that I thought that as a whole, we thought that we needed to talk about.
Your relationship with Operation Encore, I know, has been an ongoing one. What's it been like to have that kind of support for your community and that community surrounding your music?
So I joined Operation Encore about 6-7 years ago. And they've just been open arms. They support any veteran or spouse of veterans' music. And it's not all patriotic music. It's whatever music is touching our hearts at the time. And they help us just push forward and cultivate that artistship and whatever we need, they come alongside us. It's really nice to have not only just a group that believes in us, even after we get out of the service, but also just to give us artistic freedoms.
If I may add real quick, too, it's been really cool. Just I've been involved with various bands over the years, but it really feels like Operation Encore, like, has our back in a way that I haven't really felt very much being in the industry. Like, it feels less like a label and more kind of like a brotherhood in a sense.
100%.
I'm not in the armed forces, but I know Zach's been doing a lot of stuff with them. They do, like, different outreach programs, and they did a retreat, like, what was it, back in August or something? You guys went to Alaska. Yep. And had this big, like, mental health retreat, and
yeah,
it seems like they really try to take care of their guys, and they've been really great helping us fund everything, and they mm-hmm. got us in touch with Victor and Valor as well, who's been doing
creating our website currently.
Yeah, nice.
Creating a whole, like, campaign for us, yeah, like, free of charge, just because they want to support veterans. So.
Yeah. They sent me on a wellness retreat to Alaska with Otz Kilcher, who's, oddly enough, Jules' dad.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he and I became...
Name drop.
Just I know. He's just a good guy.
Yeah,
and he and I
sure.
just have become buddies. And he and I are writing some tunes as well. But, yeah, Operation Encore, I wouldn't be the artist I am, and I don't think we'd be the band that we are without the love and support that they brought.
Yeah, for sure.
Conversation and music from Yuppie on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Up next on WYSO Weekend, our Friday edition of Today from the Ohio Newsroom, and we'll wrap up our program with Bird Note.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, Ohio's Pumpkin Pro.
Support for Today from the Ohio Newsroom comes from Ohio CASA. 15,000 Ohio children are in foster care at any given time. CASA volunteers advocate for these children. Information at ohiocasa.org.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors all over Ohio. I'm Claire Roth. Each Friday of October, we're exploring the spooky side of Ohio. This Freaky Friday, we're meeting a Central Ohio artist who makes a canvas out of massive fall crops. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford reports.
Like a lot of Ohioans, Gus Smith Heisler gets the itch to carve a pumpkin each autumn. But instead of going to a grocery store or a pumpkin patch, he brings in a forklift.
Right, I don't think it's been one this big.
A giant gourd, weighing about 900 pounds, heavier than a grizzly bear, is lifted into a makeshift studio outside of Oakland Nursery in Dublin, which is setting up for a fall festival. It will become the festival's centerpiece, and one of nearly 20 pumpkins that Smith Heisler will carve this season.
So that's my canvas I have to work with today.
Smith Heisler is an engineer by trade, but started growing giant pumpkins as a hobby a couple decades back. At a weigh-off competition, he suggested someone should carve the pumpkins, too.
They said, you have the knife, go ahead. So I started carving. Pretty soon people were coming by, how long have you been carving? I said, oh, about an hour. And, well, no, I mean professionally. And I said, oh, about an hour, I guess.
In the almost 25 years since, Squash Carver, as he's dubbed himself, has spent every Halloween season traveling across Ohio, etching everything from wolves howling at the moon to the eerie Ichabod Crane. He starts by studying each squash.
I have a little bit of a bump here. I have a cavern right here. So those are all things that'll go into what I decide to make out of it.
Today, the behemoth's blemishes are inspiring something fantastical. He sketches out a battle between knight and dragon. When it's time to carve, he doesn't cut straight through like you would for a typical jack-o'-lantern. Instead, he uses a peeler to take away layers and add depth to the picture. With each scrape, the knight's sword becomes sharper and the dragon's claws clearer. He switches to a small knife and carves deeper into the fall fruit to reveal a darker, yellowish hue. Pumpkin rinds pile on his shoes as families excitedly pause their shopping to watch.
He must be a professional.
He's peppered with the usual questions. Where did he get a pumpkin so big? Specialty growers. How long will it take to finish? About 4 to 5 hours.
It's a performance art. I'm performing for their audience. So it really is kind of a mix of the actual art itself and being able to do it in front of people so they can see that it's not AI. You know, that they can see that it's real.
His art isn't strictly autumnal. Once fall ends, Smith Heisler will pivot from pumpkins to other sculptable snacks. Cheese, chocolate, watermelon. But it's the squashes that have earned him a large social media following and even a spot on the reality TV competition Halloween Wars. And though few will become professionals, Smith Heisler believes everyone can be inspired to take risks, find what excites them, and throw themselves into their craft.
It's a feeling of freedom to create when, you know, we kind of lose that as adults. We get into the working world. We feel like we don't have the time for it, but it really is a wonderful ability to express yourself this way.
He encourages all Ohioans to do the same, perhaps on a smaller gourd. His advice, go slow and cut away from your fingers. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Kendall Crawford in Dublin.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you Monday.
This is Bird Note. Whether you live in the East or the West, you may have seen towhees. They're among the most widespread and familiar birds in North America. Both birds, the Eastern towhee and the Spotted towhee of the West, sport a black or dark brown hood and back, and when they fly, their tails flash white. When a hawk gives chase, the towhee's flashing tail feathers draw the predator's attention. Momentarily distracted, the hawk may miss seeing the towhee's darkly colored head and back. As a result, the vital head and breast of the towhee remain protected. The hawk may come up with just a couple of tail feathers as the towhee escapes into the underbrush. So, if you see a towhee missing a couple of tail feathers, it may be that the flash of white, the distractive plumage, saved its life. Towhees can be easy to see because they spend most of their time near the ground. This makes them easier for kids to spot, and it makes for a fun expedition to go looking for a towhee and its flashing tail. Watch for a black and orange bird, a little smaller than a robin, scuffling in the leaves. To see photos of the towhee, come to birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the program. And find us again next weekend when we'll have lots more conversation and music coming your way. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll see you then.